The Day of the Covenant and the Battle of Blood River. This is one of the chapters and sketches from South African history, which has also now been translated into Afrikaans, and we've just had them back from the printer this week, so Sketch uit die Suid-Afrikaanse Geskiedenis is now available. So tonight at this Reformation Study, we want to look at the Day of the Covenant and the Battle of Blood River. Deuteronomy 7:9. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. For over a century and a half throughout South Africa, 16 December has been observed as the Day of the Covenant, marking the decisive Battle of Blood River. The Day of the Covenant has been recognized by many not only as a victory for the Voortrekkers, but as a triumph for Western civilization and Christianity in Africa. Like this monument, the symbolism is of the different treks of Louis Trichard, Hendrik Potgieter, Geert Maritz, Piet Retief, and Peter Ace. And the lines extending skyward are representing the divine struggle and the restlessness of the trek group, symbolize the law-abiding community as well as the wagon lager, and the concave also of the structure of the wagon. And the upward sweeping arm suggests not only the ox horns, but also the surge forward and the higher ideals of independence and freedom. And the water bowl linking the columns with five chutes symbolize the faith of the Voortrekkers and the outward flow of the water spreading the Christian religions and civilization. So this is just one of the many monuments around the country symbolizing what was behind the Great Trek. Before the Battle of Blood River, 16 December 1838, there were no known Zulu Christians. Despite the dedicated spiritual labors of British and American missionaries amongst Zulus for 18 years previously, full-time missionaries dedicated to reaching Zulus, even based at Ungungungluvu, but they'd failed to have one single baptized convert. So great was the hold of superstition, the reign of terror of the Zulu kings, and the fear of the witch doctors, that no Zulus were known to have responded to the preaching of the gospel before the defeat of Dingaan's MPs at Blood River. You could similarly note that despite the strenuous labours of famous British missionary Robert Moffat and others amongst the Matabele in what became Rhodesia, where I grew up, there were no known baptised Matabele converts to Christianity before the defeat of Lubengula's impis in the Matabele War of 1893. So the Battle of Blood River marks the beginning of the spiritual liberation of the Zulu. Observing the significance of the Day of the Covenant is not in any sense anti-Zulu. I have many precious friends amongst the Zulu. My Biblical Principles for Africa book, one of our bestsellers ever, is dedicated to Reverend Fano Sibisi of KwaSubantu Mission, who said at one of the conferences I was speaking at, Peter is a real Zulu. He said, his skin may be white, but his heart is black. He said, he sticks in the assegai and he licks the blood off the blade. So that was meant to be a compliment. But coming from a Zulu, you couldn't be married, you couldn't be considered a man until you'd washed your spear in blood. So I sent this, the chapter that makes up this presentation, to Fano Sibisi and other friends of mine at KwaSubantu to see if they approved and did I get the Zulu history right from their perspective and so on. And I did not preach on it or lecture it or publish it until I'd gotten the approval of my Zulu friends. Having read extensively on the Zulu history and visited many of the strategic battle sites and museums in Zululand, I have to regard the covenant made by the Boers and the Battle of Blood River as the beginning of the spiritual liberation of Zululand. Only after the Battle of Blood River did hundreds, then thousands of Zulus come to Christ. After their victory over Dingaan's forces, the Afrikaans Christians built a magnificent mission station and church at Umgungungluvu, Dingaanstad, within sight of where the trek leader Piet Retief and 100 of his followers were murdered. And this church, also made in the shape of the Zulu attack formation, of the Zulu impi formation, very bold cross. The Afrikaans missionaries then built a school for the blind, a school for the deaf, an evangelist's training college, and other expressions of Christian love for the former enemies at the very headquarters of Dingaan, where the massacre had taken place. And after the final defeat of the Zulu military in the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879, the Zulus came to Christ by the hundreds of thousands. Today, there are millions of Zulu Christians especially at Kwasibantu Mission and amongst their outstations. As a descendant of the Vikings, I look to our former enemy, King Alfred the Great, as one of my spiritual forefathers. Although the original Hammonds would have been amongst the Viking invaders of England, I recognize that the conversion and discipling of the once brutal Vikings began with the military victory of King Alfred the Great and his Saxon armies over the Vikings. In the same way, I believe that our Zulu brothers and sisters in Christ can rejoice at the spiritual liberation of the Zulu nation that began with the original Day of the Covenant. The scripture speaks of possessing the gates of the enemies. Those who have been justified by faith are known as children of Abraham. The father of the faithful was tested by the Lord when he was required to prepare his own son Isaac for sacrifice. Abraham foresaw the coming of Jesus Christ when he declared, God himself will provide the lamb. And God sent his angel to stop Abraham. Do not lay your hand on the lad or have anything to do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. The word of the Lord was revealed to Abraham. In blessing I will bless thee, in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gates of his enemies. We call to be a blessing to the nations. In Christ, the Abraham covenant of Genesis 12 and Genesis 22 are fulfilled. These are messianic prophecies. In Matthew 16, Christ declares he is building his church and the gates of hell cannot prevail against his church. The cultural mandates of Genesis 1:28 and the Great Commission in Matthew 28 are fulfilled in the children of Abraham being faithful and living and proclaiming the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. Entire nations will be blessed as they are brought under the whole counsel of God's word. As God's people, we need to know God and we need to make him known. We need to understand our history in order to build for a better future. We need to understand the times and know what God wants us to do. Shaka and the Mifikan. King Shaka built the Zulu nation into a great warlike nation and he released waves of destruction, Ipi Ibomvu, or total war, that left enormous stretches of country uninhabited by people. The Mifikan, unleashed by Shaka, had led to the annihilation of literally hundreds of tribes. Known as the Black Napoleon, Shaka had soaked Southern African blood, devastating countless kraals, particularly between 1820 and 1824. So when Napoleonic wars were over in Europe, they were just Shaka's wars were just starting in Southern Africa. Shaka was described as tall, handsome, and a military genius. He molded the previously insignificant Zulu tribe into a mighty war machine. He introduced new systems of fighting, abandoning the old long throwing spears and introducing the far more lethal short-handled, broad-bladed assegai. He compelled his men to throw away their sandals and to harden their feet. His regiments, his impis, would be compelled to dance on thorns, and if anyone showed pain, they were immediately executed. Instead of standing at a distance, singing and taunting the enemy and ineffectually throwing their spears, Shaka trained his men to fight as a cohesive unit in the shape of cattle horns. The most experienced troops were at the head to gore, and the younger warriors were put in the horns to encircle the enemy, to run and to encircle him. And the Zulu tribe were trained to rush in for the kill. While the others were just getting warmed up and singing their songs, they would really be on top of them. Many of these tribes that they overwhelmed, they annihilated. And many of the young women and young boys from these defeated tribes amalgamated in the Zulu tribe, but the older people and the warriors were exterminated as of no use. The young ones, they thought they could maybe amalgamate later. If Shaka had killed a lot of people, Mzilikazi killed more. One of Shaka's most effective generals, Mzilikazi, was a dynamic and ambitious man. He is born in 1790, make him slightly the junior of Shaka's born in 1787. Mzilikazi was 34 years old when, with his impi, he fled Zululand and founded the Madibili nation. To avoid retribution at the hands of his king, Shaka, Mzilikazi led his men on a devastating path of blood through the what became the Transvaal and Orange Free State and Botswana, and he later settled in what became Rhodesia. Mzilikazi spared the most promising of the vanquished tribes to be incorporated into his army and tribe, and he molded this heterogeneous horde into a great nation using the best of Zulu military tactics. And his path through the interior of southern Africa was as devastating as a veld fire. He slaughtered, captured, plundered, left destruction in his wake. It's estimated that the Matabele alone exterminated 156 tribes. Until his defeat at the hands of the Boers at Vegekop, where Paul Kruger was one of the men fighting, although he's only 10 years old at the time, the Matabele were operating out of Western Transvaal. Their defeat at the hands of Hendrik Potgieter's trekkers led Mzilikazi's men to flee across the Limpopo River to settle in Matabele land in what became Rhodesia, and ultimately Zimbabwe, which is where I grew up. This is the monument at Battle of Vegekop. Notice this man is kneeling down as in submission to God, raising his rifle with barrel point downward, showing submission to the power of God. And it's like the shield of faith is protecting him, but the arrows, the askars are just twisting, bending, and breaking upon him. And that's just symbolic of the Battle of Vegekop. Well, the Rhodesians in 1890 crossed the Limpopo. They faced the Matabele. Other battles, Alan Wilson's patrol, a whole new story, but that the Matabele became the Rhodesians' problem later. On the 22nd of September 1828, Shaka, the founder and king of the Zulus, was stabbed to death by his half-brothers, Princes Dingaan and Malangana. Missionaries and English traders who visited Zululand described Dingaan as astute, sly, cruel, temperamental, brutal, charming, diplomatic, and treacherous. Shortly after murdering his half-brother, imagine being able to murder your brother, Dingaan quickly arranged the assassination of his co-conspirator and half-brother, Malangana, and then systematically execute all his aristocratic rivals, anyone else who could possibly be a danger to him, including the commander-in-chief of Shaka's army, Laka, who he had strangled. Dingaan was about 30 years old when he seized power. He began to build up a new capital for himself at Ungungungluwa, the place of the great elephant. Dingaan quickly accumulated over 300 wives and concubines, and traders and missionaries described Dingaan's appetite as ferocious. He became extremely obese. Unlike his brother Shaka, Dingaan preferred to stay at his palace. He was not a warrior. He wasn't like Shaka. Instead of leading military campaigns, he sent out his impis and remained at Umgungungluwa, surrounded by a continual program of feasting and dancing. Enter Gullible's Travels. When trek leader Piet Retief came to Dingaan to negotiate the right for the fur trekkers to settle in the depopulated territory between the Tugela and the Bushman's River, what today is Natal, he was warned by the missionaries that one of the principal objectives of Shaka and Dingaan had been to totally depopulate the surrounding territory as far as the soldiers could penetrate, so that his followers, over whom he held total despotic sway, might have no asylum, no refuge, if they attempt to escape his murderous rule, that they were fleeing over scorched earth, depopulated territory where they could easily be hunted out and killed. Retief was also warned that the defeat of the renegade Zulu general Mzilikazi at the hands of the Boers, Potgieter and Saraseliers, in the Transvaal had sent shockwaves throughout Zululand. As Dingaan's military expeditions against Mzilikazi had all been indecisive, he feared the power of the Boers. How can these few farmers beat this unbeatable general and his army, which we couldn't beat? Yet Piet Retief seemed supremely self-confident and brushed aside every warning about the danger of the dictator with whom he is attempting to negotiate. This is Ungungungluwa. Dingaan's capital, Ungungungluwa, was described as an effective, efficient military camp entirely fenced in with thorn bushes. The king's quarters dominated the high ground, and it overlooked 2,000 huts to the side of the main entrance in the open area, and each hut accommodated 20 warriors, and within the lines of the military kraals, huts were strongly fenced in with cattle kraals. Dingaan's own quarters consist of hundreds of beehive huts, including huts for his enormous harem and his council house and reception hall, both some 20 feet in height. With the roof supported by 22 pillars, entirely covered in beadwork, the floors were made of mud and dung, polished with blood and fat until they shone like a mirror. Ungungungluwa was arranged in ovals, circles, semicircles, with thousands of beehive huts appearing like beads in a necklace. Facing the capital on the other side of the stream below was the Hill of Execution, Kwa Matawani. Now, if you wanted to go into the presence of Dingaan, he required his subjects to throw themselves on the ground and crawl forward in the dust for about 200 meters before coming to halt a good distance from his throne. Well, Pete Retief and the other white visitors refused to succumb to such indignity, and they stood in the presence of the king, polite but not abasing themselves. They noted that Dingaan was entirely hairless. He shaved every day, and he is described as having an abhorrence of human hair. So imagine what they thought about the Voortrekkers with their hulking great big beards. He wore many ornaments on his head, and his body was rubbed daily with fat to make him appear like polished ebony. And there were lots of warnings from missionaries. Acting as the king's secretary was Reverend Francis Owen of the Church Missionary Society. Most of what we know concerning the meetings of Pete Retief with Dingaan comes from Owen's diary. Pete Retief first reached Umgungungluv on the 5th of November 1837. The king entertained him with war dances by thousands of his warriors, and Owen warned him of the countless cruelties, tortures and executions that he had been forced to witness. However, Pete Retief seemed impressed with the sincerity, graciousness, intelligence and goodwill of Dingaan. And after seeking to impress Retief for 2 days with the parades of his regiments and herds, Dingaan informed Retief he was willing to grant the trekkers the territory his armies had depopulated across the Tugela and around Port Natal on condition that Pete Retief should return the cattle which had been taken by Sikonyela and his Batlokoa people. And as they had come on horseback, dressed in clothes, Sikonyela's people had assumed them to be Boers. So to prove that the trekkers were not in any way responsible for Sikonyela's cattle raid, he required them to deal with his chief. The Church Missionary Society missionary Franz Owen warned Pete Retief that he was wasting his time, because Dingaan was utterly inconsistent. He had already granted the same desired territory to the English government through John Gardiner, who was settled in Port Natal. However, Pete Retief regarded the expedition against Sikonyela as necessary for the vindication of their honour. Owen questioned how a man of Pete Retief's intelligence could attach any value to a promise made by a tyrant like Dingaan. A man who can stab his own brother in the back is not to be trusted. When Pete Retief later gave an enthusiastic account of the splendours of Dingaan, his kindness and his boundless hospitality, American missionary Reverend George Champion declared, "I have known Dingaan for 2 years, Mr. Retief, and I know full well what a dangerous character he is. I can only see disaster should you visit him again." Reverend Kirkwood also warned Retief of Dingaan's intention to have him put to death as a wizard. But Retief brushed all his sightings, all the warnings aside, declaring, "Have no apprehension on my account." Chief Sikonyela was described as a man who always caused trouble. He was the son of a famous warrior queen, Ma Tatatisa. He had done his share of devastating the country along the Caledon River in particular, and the remnants of the devastating tribes he moulded into the Batloka. Cattle raids were part of the African way of life, and both Sikonyela and many of the trekkers questioned Retief's actions as contrary to his own code of behaviour, which he published in the Grahamstown newspapers before leaving on the Great Trek, by interfering in intertribal affairs. Non-interference in the tribal affairs is one of the cardinal rules the trekkers pledged themselves to uphold. However, Retief felt himself justified in taking actions if these people had indeed posed as Boers. That's a big if. Retief managed to avoid bloodshed by using a pair of handcuffs to restrain Sikonyela. "Put out your hands, I've got some bracelets for you." And next thing, he declared he's under arrest, as though he would understand what that means. And they didn't take the handcuffs off if he returned the stolen cattle. Sikonyela was kept prisoner for 3 days while the 700 cattle were rounded up and identified by the accompanying Zulus. He must have found this very amusing. A passing trader warned Pete Retief of Dingaan's planned treachery against him upon his return. Fellow trek leader Geert Maritz repeatedly warned Pete Retief not to return to Dingaan, declaring, "I do not trust Dingaan. How can you trust a man who's murdered his own brother?" Maritz reminded him of the murder of Anders Stockenstrom in 1811, whilst having friendly talks with a band of Khoisas on the eastern frontier of the Cape. But every attempt to dissuade Pete Retief was brushed aside. He really was Gullible's Travels. Pete Retief, with almost 100 followers, including his son, arrived at Ungunglulu Saturday, 3rd of February. He was rebuked by Dingaan for having released Sikonyela unharmed. Dingaan was shocked that Retief had not executed him, or at least brought him to the Zulu capital for execution. Why would you capture one of my enemies and not kill him? He then requested the Boers to make a demonstration of their war dances on their horses. The trek is staged an impromptu charge on horseback in the royal arena, making the air resound with the sounds of their muskets. And Dingaan and his subjects had never seen anything like this before. They're plainly shocked at the speed and the agility of the Boers on horseback and the deafening sound of their muskets. They'd never seen or heard anything like that before. The missionary warned Retief that his display was entrenching the fear of Dingaan, that he was a wizard and a threat that must be eradicated. However, when Dingaan agreed to sign the document drawn up by Retief to cede the territory between the Tugela and the Umzumvubu rivers to the Trekkers, Retief felt all his trust in the word of Dingaan had been fulfilled. This document was placed in his leather briefcase with great relief, signed and witnessed by Reverend Owen, the missionary who was also the secretary to the king and his translator. However, the CMS missionary Reverend Owen was most disturbed that Pete Retief and his followers missed the Sunday morning worship service on the 4th of February for formalities with the king. Imagine, he's been a missionary there for years and there's no Christians, no converts, lonely work, and now you've got 100 Christians coming and they don't attend that Sunday service because they're busy being entertained by this pagan king across the way. Retief later said he had forgotten what day of the week it was, which is hard to credit. On Monday, the trekkers were treated to an endless display of war dances and military maneuvers by Dingaan's MPs. And Dingaan was described as a master showman, with his entertainment the most spectacular ever seen in the subcontinent. Dingaan again asked for a display of the Boer war tactics on horseback, and the Zulu sat stunned at the speed and perfect control of the men with their rifles on horseback. On Tuesday morning, William Wood, a young English trader who is fluent in Zulu, who was visiting Owens, warned Retief that your entire party will be massacred before the day's out. He had overheard talk and understanding Zulu, he warned him. And as the Retief party struck camp and were preparing to leave, they were invited for a final farewell display. I mean, how many final farewells can you have? For this, they requested, please leave your firearms, your bandoliers and powder horns outside the gates of the kraal. Incredibly, they acceded to this demand. Leaving their firearms outside the kraal, they walked defenseless into the arena of Dingaan's kraal, trusting in the piece of paper they had in the leather satchel of Pete Retief. After ominous war dances, which increased in volume and intensity, Dingaan stood up and shouted, Babalolani Abathakati, or kill the wizards. Cold-blooded murder. From across the stream on opposite hillside, Franz Owen was reading the New Testament when a messenger rushed up to inform that Dingaan had decided to kill the boys, but he was not to be concerned. Owen looked on with horror as he saw an immense multitude, about 9 or 10 Zulus to each Boer, dragging the helpless unarmed into the fatal spot on the hill of execution. They were not just killed. They were tortured. They were impaled on assegais. They were clubbed to death. Pete Retief was forced to see all his men killed, including his young son, before they killed him. He was the last to be killed. And amongst the dead was the interpreter, Thomas Halstead, the only Englishman of this party. Here are the names on the wall of the place at the Hill of Execution, where they were later interned. And interesting to see even de Klerk's in here, and you thought, did they not learn anything? The various missionaries who had warned Pete Retief repeatedly questioned, how could such an intelligent and experienced man as Pete Retief, how could he have been so thoroughly deceived, even mesmerized by the tyrant Dingaan? Soon the sky above the Hill of Execution was black with vultures. The heart and liver of Pete Retief was brought to Dingaan, but the rest of the corpse were left out in the open on the Hill of Execution to later be discovered along with Retief's blood-stained leather case containing the much-prized signed treaty with Dingaan. Almost 10 years to the day since Dingaan had murdered his half-brother Shaka to assume the chieftainship. That was just the beginning. About noon on that fateful Tuesday, the 6th of February, Reverend Owen saw Dingaan send out a huge army in the direction of where the Boers had come. There's no doubt that worse was to come. In the early hours of 17 February, 10,000 Zulu warriors attacked the sleeping fort trekkers between the Bushmans and the Blokrans rivers. There was no moon that night. It was pitch dark. The trekkers awoke to the sound of their dogs barking, and then wave after wave, Zulu warriors were stabbing men, women, and children, wiping out whole families. You can see some of the depictions in marble at the Fort Trekker Monument. The followers of Heer Maritz were more cautiously logged and better prepared to defend themselves, but the followers of Piet Retief were spread out and most vulnerable, with no thought of protection. Saul Saliers and Geert Maritz led charges to rescue fleeing trekkers. Women and children, even as young as 10 years old, fought tenaciously, selling their lives dearly. Martinus Oorsesen charged through the mass of Zulus to a wagon for ammunition and then back again to resupply the beleaguered Van Rensburgs, who were surrounded on a hill. Fighting continued until afternoon of the 17th of February. When the Zulu army retreated, they took over 25,000 cattle, many horses and sheep with them, making the fur trekkers completely destitute. I mean, this was their livelihood. Many hundreds of the Zulu attackers had been killed in the fierce fighting. As the fur trekkers began to count up their own dead, they grieved over the loss of 185 of the children murdered. Of the women, 56 dead, including even grandmothers, many with many assegai wounds. So 185 women of the children killed, women murdered 56, men 40. Incredibly, some women had been horribly stabbed were found alive amongst the piles of dead. Johanna van der Merwe and Margarita Prinsloo each survived despite 20 assegai wounds each. And Klasina LaRue had 17 stab wounds and survived. As Geert Maritz organized the mass burial of the slain trekkers, the sky was full of circling vultures, and the sounds of weeping could be heard throughout the area. So the Boers later found a town at the site of the massacre, which they called Vienen, the place of weeping. This was followed by the ambush on Buffalo River. On the 6th of April, a counterattack by a Boer commander led by two rival leaders, Piet Ace and Andreas Potgieter, was ambushed across the Buffalo River at Italeni. A British expedition from Port Natal rushed to assist the beleaguered trekkers, but 10 of the commander were killed, including Piet Ace and his brave son Durkie, who rode back to keep fighting by his father's side to the very end, as depicted in this marble at the Fort Trekker Monument. As this commander retreated, became known as the Vlug Commander, or the Fleeing Commander. It was the darkest time of despair for the Fort Trekkers. Death, disaster, dissension seemed to doom their ambitious enterprise. And then Andreas Pretorius came from Graaffreinet. He was not committed to Great Trek until he heard about this disaster. With the arrival of Andreas Pretorius from Graaffreinet, there was fresh hope. The widow of Piet Retief declared of Andreas Pretorius, "This man has been sent by God. He will help us obtain justice." Andreas Pretorius was a dynamic, pistol-packing farmer from Graaffreinet. He was described as a tall, imposing figure in a well-cut suit with a pistol and a cutlass at his belt. He came also with 60 volunteers for the Ven Commander, the Victory Commander, that he intended to organize. At an assembly of the Volksraad, Pretorius was elected Commandant General. Within a couple of days, he is heading out with 464 men, 64 wagons, to engage the Zulus. Pretorius adopted the motto Eindracht macht Macht, unity is strength. These words were to become the motto of the Transvaal Republic. All in the Ven Commander, the Victory Commander, were lectured in discipline, Christian conduct, decency, integrity, compassion, and courage. As God's soldiers, their conduct had to be of a high standard. It's said that the Afrikaans people were probably never more united than at this moment. The chaplain, Cyril Siliers, who was a veteran of the Battle of Vechtkop, who was widely respected as a man of God, who had proved himself in battle at Vechtkop, ensured strict religious observance with daily devotions and prayer times where the men were required to kneel. Now, bear in mind, at this stage, there wasn't a single dominie on the trek because the Dutch Reformed Church had forbidden any of their participants or members to take part in the trek. They saw the Great Trek as rebellion against the lawful government, even though it was the British government. They forbade their people to take part in it. And effectively, the trekkers were without any church support. And the first Dutch form person to be sent, dominie, to care for the trekkers was sent in 1849, and that would have been Andrew Murray. And that's why the Chelefa Medekerk was started, with Paul Kruger being one of the founders, and his family being very involved, because the Chelefa Medekerk was founded to provide a church for the people who had effectively been abandoned by the Dutch Reformed Church, who said, well, if you go on a great trek, then you're not part of our church because you're rebels. So Saul Siliers would have been one of the founders, in a sense, of the Chelefa Medekerk. Not that they had that term at that stage. So he required them to have strict religious observance, with daily devotions and prayer times, where the men were all required to kneel. On the move, the 64 wagons traveled in four rows so as not to make the column too long for the vanguards and rear guards to protect them from ambush. Every night, their lager was drawn up and sentries posted, inspections held, defensive drills practiced. Scouting patrols were sent out every day to ascertain the whereabouts of the Zulu army and to identify any potential threats. And they made the covenant. As the Tugela River was flooded, the Venkamada crossed near Spionkop. At Vashbank on Sunday the 9th of December, Saul Siliers stood on a gun carriage before the men who had assembled for worship, and he proposed a solemn vow, a covenant. My brethren and countrymen, at this moment we stand before the holy God of heaven and earth to make a promise. If he will be with us and protect us and deliver us, deliver the enemy into our hands so that we may triumph over him, that we shall observe the day and the date as an anniversary in each year, and a day of thanksgiving, like the Sabbath, in his honor, and that we shall enjoin our children, that they must take part with us in this, for remembrance even to our posterity. And if anyone sees a difficulty in this, let him return from this place, for the honor of his name shall be joyfully exalted, and to him the fame and the honor of the victory must be given. All the English volunteers joined the Afrikaans volunteers in taking this vow. From 9 December, the vow was repeated every evening up till the night of the 15th, during evening service when psalms were sung and prayers were offered. They were going to confront the Zulu. There was a calm deliberation amongst the men of the Ven Commander. There were no women in this commander. They knew that there's a good chance they'd be wiped out, so it was men only. They knew they were going up against the most formidable force in Africa at that time. Up to that point, the Zulu impis had never been beaten. They knew Dingaan had over 20,000 warriors that he could throw at them. They were only 464 men, and this being 1838, they only had smooth ball muskets which took 30 to 40 seconds to reload if you were really good and fast. They knew that charging Zulu warriors could cover a lot of ground in that time. On Saturday the 15th of December, the commander crossed the Buffalo River, outspanned between the Buffalo River and the Nkome River, and two scouts reported that they'd seen a huge Zulu army only half an hour ride away. Pretorius inspected the terrain for a suitable lager site, and he sensed God's guidance, for there was the perfect spot on the other side of the Nkome River. On its western bank was a deep hippopotamus pool and a large donga or gully. The lager was set up making use of these two natural defensive features on two of their sides. The 64 wagons were firmly lashed together. The two battle gates were secured at the two openings where cannon were placed. And the back of the deformation was set against the donga, and the semicircle faced towards the open plain. Candles were set out everywhere on lanterns suspended over the wagons on long whip handles to prevent the Zulus from approaching log unseen in the night. As Saul Siliers led the commander in repeating the vow for the last time and then singing the psalms, the Zulus had moved with an earshot and could hear the strange singing and see the eerily lit lager. They'd planned an attack at night, actually, just like they had at Blokrans River. But a hyena ran across their ranks, and this spooked them, and they thought there's something very strange. Then they heard these eerie sounds, and even though they'd been ordered to attack at night, they did not. It was a suspenseful, moonless night, and it's questionable whether anyone slept on either side. 2 hours before dawn, the trekkers were at their post, and a veil of mist lifted, and a perfect day broke. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was a vivid blue day. There was no wind. It's a day of crystal clarity, the eyewitnesses said. As the mist lifted, the Boers saw the entire Zulu army seated facing them with their shields in front. The front row of Zulus was only 40 paces, 40 meters, away from their half moon of wagons. Row after row of Zulu regiments were grouped according to the color of their shields, the white shields, the brown shields, the black shields, the blue, the black and white shields, and so on. There were at least 15,000 Zulus surrounding their lager. "Do not fear their numbers, we can deal with them," shouted Pretorius. And as the warriors were moving into position to attack from the Donga at the rear, Commandant Pretorius decided to seize the initiative. He immediately ordered his men to open fire. Before the Zulus could even begin the intimidating war dances, the roar of the gunfire shattered the early morning peace. The day began in furious battle, with Zulus yelling, hissing, smashing the assegais against their shields, thunderously stamping the ground with their feet, charging the log at full speed. Normally this would be sufficient to have whoever they were attacking flee. I mean, just that thunderous, when they all hit their shields at the same time and thumping the ground with their feet, normally any enemy they had fled. The two little cannon cut swathes through the Zulu ranks and the deadly aim of the Boer commanders took their toll. As a mass of Zulus tried to scale the Donga and assault the rear of the laager, Charles Hilliers led his men to cut them down. As the Zulus retreated out of range of about 500 meters, Pretorius sent out his brother and interpreter to taunt the Zulus and say, "What are you doing, men of Dingaan? We've come to fight men, not women and children. Why don't you attack?" The Zulus leapt up to attack, drumming their shields, yelling, whistling, hissing, and they swept down a big black wave upon the wagons. This is the longest charge of the two-hour battle. Muzzles were becoming dangerously hot, wagons bristled with assegais, but the strategic positioning of the laager was frustrating the assaults of the Zulus. The closer they got to the wagons, the more they were funneled and compressed by the wind, river and the Donga, until they were tripping into one another, stumbling over the earlier casualties, and their losses were becoming enormous, yet without achieving anything. Never in the experience of their warrior nation had anything like this happened to them before. Andreas Pretorius sensed a change in the tempo of the battle and he ordered a charge from the laager. He had the two wagon dragged out and fired from the front, and then he led a charge into the middle of the Zulu impi. For the first time in history, a Zulu impi broke and fled. The cohesion on which the Zulu impis was based was shattered, and the Zulus began to flee across the Nkomo River, many drowning in the process. Most of them couldn't swim. The only way they crossed rivers was all linked together like one big long chungalolo. Centipedes, and they'd all take arms and help one another across. But when they were fleeing, they were washed away. As Pretorius fired on one Zulu, his horse reared and threw him off. Actually, it wasn't his horse. In the confusion, he picked the wrong horse. A Zulu lunged at him, and Pretorius managed to ward off the assegai with his rifle. As the Zulu struck again, Pretorius was thrust through his left hand. He then pinned the Zulu to the ground, grappled hand to hand with the warrior, and stabbed him with his own assegai. And they pursued the enemy. On the other side, Charles Hilliers led a commander charge that put to flight the other section of the Zulu army. The mounted Boers pursued the fleeing Zulu, shooting at them as long as their bullets lasted, and then firing pebbles when all their bullets were exhausted. Over 3,000 Zulu were counted around the laager dead, yet not one voortrekker had been killed, although several had been injured. As the sun set, the exhausted commander members returned for service of thanksgiving. For their first meal of the day, said they hadn't even had time to brew their coffee when the beginning of the battle started in the morning. It was sunset before anyone got anything to eat or drink. Then they had to clean their muskets, cast bullets for the final push to track down Dingaan at Umgungunglovu. And there they found the remains of Piet Retief and his followers. By the 20th of December, the Zulu capital was sighted. It was ablaze from one end to the other. Dingaan had fled and set fire to his own capital. When the grisly remains of Piet Retief and his 100 followers were discovered at Kwa Mitawani, they saw the legs and arms still tied with thongs, the impaling stick still visible. And next to the remains of Piet Retief lay his water bottle, his leather satchel, which had contained Dingaan's signed and witnessed agreement for the cessation of Natal, drawn up by Reverend Owen, actually. On Christmas Day, the remains of these victims were all gathered and buried in a communal grave at the foot of the kopje, which you can visit to this day. The Zulu kingdom then fell into a civil war and Dingaan was overthrown by his half-brother Mapandi. And he ended up stabbed in the back, just like he had done to his brother Shaka. What goes around comes around, the wheel turns, what you sow is what you reap. Interestingly enough, Andreas Pretorius was at the coronation of King Mapandi. And from that point, the Zulu and the Boer have never fought against one another. When the British were mobilizing for the Anglo-Zulu War in 1879, they called on the Boers to join them, and the Boers said no. Now, I know that the film Zulu and Zulu Dawn depicts some Boers fighting for the British, but that's not historic. There were no Boers fighting for the British. They said, we've got no quarrel with the Zulu. And in fact, at the first major memorial service held 28 years after the battle. So in 1866, on the 16th of December, there was a memorial service at the site of the battle on the banks of the Comb River. And actually, eyewitnesses who'd been to battle built the cairn that you can still see in the middle there. Prince Keshweo was there, who later became king of the Zulus, and he spoke at this event. He says, since this battle, the Zulu and the Boer have been like neighbors under the same roof, and we will never fight one another again. We're now friends. And in fact, it's true. So when people speak about Day of Reconciliation, it's been a Day of Reconciliation since 1866. The Zulu and the Boers never fought one another again. King Mpande was a good neighbor to the Boers, and the Boers were good neighbors to him. And you can see how they loved their enemies. It's remarkable that despite the treachery that the Boers had endured at the hands of the Zulu and the massacres of so many unsuspecting women and children on the banks of the Blokrans River, that no atrocities were committed by the Boers in retaliation. Instead, the biblical injunction to love your enemies was fulfilled by vigorous missionary work, which was established by the Reformed churches in Zululand, establishing schools, hospitals, churches, and orphanages, and for the blind and for the deaf. Even within sight where Piet Retief and his followers were so brutally murdered. In the century and a half since that original Day of the Covenant, many millions of Zulus have come to Christ, and Zululand has been blessed by revival. In a very real sense, all of that began with a covenant proposed by Cyril Siliers and enthusiastically adopted by the then commander. Kwasimantu mission being the most obvious, massive evidence of the grace of God that's been poured out amongst the Zulu. One of the greatest mission stations in the world. Bill Bathman says it's the greatest mission station. Well, I call it the most successful, most blessed mission station in Africa. He said, Peter, you can upgrade that to the world. He says, I've been in 114 countries. Let me tell you, there's nothing to compare with Kwasimantu anywhere in the world. And so, well, I can speak for Africa. This is the most blessed mission station in Africa, I will say. And what God has done through Reverend Erlo Stegen and his co-workers at Kwasimantu is just remarkable. Ministers' conferences, 1,000 to 2,000 ministers every 2 years. Youth conferences twice a year, 7,000 to 8,000 young people at a youth conference. And they have no gimmicks. It's just the gospel, it's hymns, it's prayer, it's reality. The Lord is good. His mercy is everlasting. His truth endures for all generations. The Zulu were set free to serve Christ. Just as the descendants of the Vikings can look back to their one-time enemy, King Alfred the Great, as their spiritual father brought the first Vikings to the Lord after defeating them in battle, so the Zulus and the Afrikaners and the English, with whom they had once been locked in deadly battle, are now united in Christ. On some of our missions in Zululand, I've taken teams to Battle of Blood River, Battle of Isandlwana, Battle of Rooks Drift, with Zulu, English and Afrikaans people in the same group. A Boer victory, Zulu victory, British victory. And you could see all of us could rejoice in the lessons learned at each one of those battles, even though our forefathers were fighting one another at one time. Battle of Rooks Drift. Incredible what happened there. With the defeat of Dingaan, later Keshweo, the power of the witch doctors was also broken, and a spiritual liberation of the Zulu people began. Do you know when the British finally captured Keshweo, 1879, after the Battle of Ulundi? As the Zulu king was taken captivity, the British officer ordered present arms, and the entire British army stood at attention and presented arms to the Zulu king, the man who had given them the worst defeat they'd ever suffered at the hands of a native army. They'd massacred everyone, even the little drummer boys, and disemboweled them. They were not nice people. They were vicious, savage heathen. And yet, only the British would order people to present arms and salute the savage king. And when he came to Cape Town, he was treated like royalty by General Charles Gordon, the Chinese Gordon, as he's called, Commandant General of the Cape. He didn't put him in a dungeon as the British had ordered him to, because he's an evangelical Christian, Victorian evangelical Christian, Commandant General of the castle. And he shared the gospel with Keshwa. He saw that the gospel was translated into Zulu, and he was, in fact, General Gordon is the one who, when he was fired from the Cape, because he took the Zulu side in the Anglo-Zulu War and he took the Boer side in the Anglo-Boer War, the British couldn't stand this evangelical general who was actually on the side of the enemies, because General Gordon was a fair-minded person. He said, well, we drew first blood, we attacked them. I mean, they didn't attack us. This is not a just war. And so as Commandant General of the Cape, he is basically kicked out. And it was Cecil Rhodes who said, General Gordon is a remarkable man. He has no interest in money. He's the only person he sort of had come across he couldn't buy. He had no price. And it's General Gordon who, when he was fired from the army effectively, left the Cape and went up to the Holy Land and did archaeological research and Bible study for a year, published Reflections in Palestine, and identified the Garden Tomb and what's today called Gordon's Tomb or Gordon's Calvary, but it's not Gordon's, it's Christ's Tomb, Christ's Calvary. But he's the one identified, because all the Catholics and Orthodox are going to some place where a monk had a vision and said, this is the site, and they built all their edifices over it and put all their superstitious mumbo-jumbo there. But the Protestants can go to where General Gordon identified it. Interesting link, South Africa, Sudan, Zulu. But here is the Zulu king being led into captivity by the British, and he was brought all the way down to Cape and put in at the castle, as we have shown. Well, he's meant to be in the prison there, but they actually let him walk around as an honored guest. Isawana, this is the Zulu clause of courage that was awarded to a courageous warrior in the shadow of Isawana, where they fought the British in 1879. As the Lord promised in Genesis 22, verse 17, thy seed shall possess the gates of his enemy. Jesus Christ is building his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You are blessed and ought to be a blessing. God's promise to Abraham is being fulfilled to this day. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse them who curses you. In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Genesis 12, verse 1 to 3 is a messianic prophecy fulfilled in Christ. Galatians 3 says, not to seeds as to many, but to one seed, which is Christ. That this is fulfilled in Christ, and if we are his faithful followers, then we can expect blessings to flow where we are blessed to him. Now, this is just one chapter in the sketches or skitsa uit die Suid-Afrikaanse geskiedenis. Today, you can go up to Fort Trickett Monument and see some magnificent monuments and memorials to all this. We have this on a reformationsa.org web as an article. We'll be sure to add the video of this presentation as well, the audio. But the Fort Trickett Monument has got magnificent symbolism. Under the foundation stone is buried a copy of the covenant vow made by the Fort Trickett on the eve of the Battle of Blood River, 16 December 1838. A copy of the anthem De Stem that we sang at the beginning tonight, and a copy of the land deal for Natal signed by Dingaan, King of the Zulus, after Piet Retief had fulfilled the conditions he had required, is also buried under the cornerstone. The monument was inaugurated 16 December 1949. The Fort Trickett Monument is 40 meters high with a base of 40 meters by 40 meters. Very formidable. It contains the largest marble frieze in the world. The frieze consists of 27 marble relief panels depicting the history of the Great Trek, the life, the struggles, and the fervent Christian faith of the Fort Trekkers. In many ways, the marble frieze depicting the vision and the journeys and the sufferings and achievements of the Fort Trekkers parallels the exodus of the Hebrews from Egypt. And most of the Fort Trekkers had only one book in their wagons, and that was the Bible. And they read it every night, and they saw obvious parallels to what the Hebrews experienced coming out of Egypt. In the center of the floor of this hall of heroes is a large circular opening through which the cenotaph can be viewed. That's this monument, this altar. The cenotaph, situated in the center of the monument, is the central focus. Ons vir jou, Suid-Afrika. The architect intended the cenotaph to resemble an altar, symbolic of the altar that was established by Noah after the flood and by Abraham, the father of the faithful. Through an opening in a dome, a ray of sunlight shines at 12 o'clock on the 16th of December every year, falling on the center of the cenotaph, highlighting the words, Ons vir jou, Suid-Afrika. This ray of light is to symbolize God's blessing on the lives and endeavors of the Voortrekkers. The cenotaph hall is decorated with the flags of the various Voortrekker republics. Notice how the St. Andrew's cross is very popular. That was actually the red cross on blue, the red X. St. Andrew's cross was the main flag of the Voortrekkers during the Great Trek. And they also have other artifacts, Bibles, hymn books, psalms. Here you can see some of the flags. We've got the Vierkleur in the corner here. Always bring it out for 16 December. Against the northern wall of the hall is a nave with a lantern which the flame has been burning ever since the centenary of the Great Trek, 1938. And they started in Cape Town. They went all the way up through Graaffreinet, all the way to Pretoria, to this monument. It was in that year that the symbolic Oxwagon Trek began in Cape Town, arrived at Monument Hill, where the monument's foundation stone was then laid. It would have been finished earlier, but the Second World War made it hard to get the materials needed. Visitors to the monument enter through a black wrought iron gate made up of assegais. And surrounding the Voortrekker monument is a log of 64 oxwagons, the same number of oxwagons used at the Battle of Blood River. At the foot of the Voortrekker monument stands Anton van Vaux's stone sculpture of a Voortrekker woman and her two children. Looks like a very quiet honey. You would not want to get on the wrong side of her. As the children look to the mother for love and guidance, she looks up to the Lord for strength and wisdom. These must have been tough women who undertook the Great Trek. And you think what they went through and what they endured. On each side of the sculpture, wildebeest are chiseled into the walls of the monument, depicting the dangers of the wilderness in which the mother, representing Christian civilization, was establishing a home. And the buffalo head, I'm sure Colonel Breitmark would be most approving of this, a buffalo head, symbolic of the Buffalo Battalion, but this symbolized the kind of wilderness they had to tame. On each outside corner of the Voortrekker monument, there's a statue representing Piet Retief, Andreas Pretorius, Hendrik Potgieter, and a fourth leader meant to represent all the other Trek leaders, standing like sentinels at the corner. And looking out over, one mil, that's one military hospital just across from Voortrekkerhoogte. The Greek cross floor plan reflected the fact that the New Testament was initially revealed in Greek and the centrality of God's words emphasized in the very structure. The monument's huge upper dome is designed to draw the visitor's eyes upwards towards God as our creator, the sovereign Lord and eternal judge, and there's the hole in the ceiling through which the light shines. When you climb up there, if you are scared of heights, you would not want to be looking down from there. But as God communicates in general revelation through nature and in special revelation through scripture, the architect, Muderijk, determined to focus on both the word of God and the works of God, both in history and in nature. A beautiful garden of indigenous flowers and plants and trees surrounds the monument, reflecting our duty to fulfill the cultural mandate. In fact, it's one of the most beautiful places to go. The 3.4 kilometer squared area around the monument was declared a nature reserve in 1992. I've seen zebra, blesbuck, mountain reedbuck, springbok, and impala. They're all flourishing in this nature reserve around the monument. The Bible presented by the English-speaking 1820 settlers to the departing Voortrekkers is prominent in the marble historic frieze, emphasizing the importance of the Great Commission. And there are many, like this one is just one of the Bibles. This Bible was presented to Jacobus Ace by the British settlers on his departure from the Cape Colony. And at the time they said, God has placed us at the foot of Africa to take the light of the gospel of Christ throughout Africa. From a distance, the Voortrekker monument resembles an altar, symbolizing Afrikaans people's determination to be consecrated to God for the fulfillment of the Great Commission. To care for God's creation, to develop civilization in the wilderness, and a commitment to fulfill the Great Commission throughout Africa. This is what our national purpose is. We're blessed in order to be a blessing. So, that's also a chapter in Sketter, just giving the symbolism of the Great Trek. Any questions or comments?
I think it's quite interesting how the current ANC regime is quite representative of Dinga. It's an unchallenged, authoritarian, gluttonous regime.
Murderers.
Murderers, yeah.
Backstabbers too.
Yeah.
Willing to murder their own brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's true. That's a good analogy. At the time when de Klerk was starting his nonsense, we said he's like Retief leaving his rifles outside the kraal. Certainly seems a lot of analogies there. Yes.
What did at the negotiations with Dingaan, if Dingaan was going to give them that land, what was he getting in return from the Boers? What was the
fact that they had retrieved the 700 cattle from Sikonyela, the enemy, was all that he had asked. Now, I mean, bear in mind the land was empty. It was scorched earth that they had devastated, and there was nothing going on there, nobody living there. So it was depopulated land between those rivers, Tugela and Umzumvubu. So that's all he asked for. But of course he had promised the same to the British, which is why once the Boers got it, the British came and took it. And then many of the trekkers went back over the Drakensberg to the Free State or Transvaal. Very few stayed there. And that's why Pieter Maritzburg, named after Pieter Retief and Gert Maritz, Pieter Maritzburg, became known as the last outpost of the British Empire, because although it was named for two Afrikaans leaders, they basically left and the British took it over. And Pieter Maritzburg, despite its Boer name, became a very, very, very English town. Just interesting background. I remember as a child at school having to do a whole model, first drawing and then model of the fort that was besieged by the trekkers at what's now the old fort in Durban, and that's all part of our history. And interesting how it turned out. And that's where Dick King's ride, he went through the whole of the Transkei, imagine the danger, to get to Grahamstown to let them know that we're being besieged up there in Durban. And then the British sent relief to, and all of that's part of how Natal or Natalia became Natal. And became British instead of a Boer republic.
That shows that they had resources, they had a cannon, they had guns. I mean, we're not allowed to have a cannon anymore.
And by the way, that was illegal. They were not allowed to take any gunpowder or muskets or so on out of the west, out of the Cape. And of course, so in many ways, the Great Trek was, civil disobedience. Which is what the Dutch Vorm Dominees were complaining about, that you're rebelling against. In fact, you're not allowed to take cannon, you're not allowed to take gunpowder, and they were like, try and stop us. And they went off. They knew what they were going into. It's a dangerous situation. So, and the British government want them to go basically unarmed, was the rules. You're not allowed to leave, and you're not allowed to take weapons out. And they all said, we've been paying taxes for ages, you do nothing to protect us, we're out of here. I mean, the British government had really abused the people. So, in fact, that abused the 1820 settlers too, because the 1820 settlers were British and German soldiers who had fought for the British in the Napoleonic Wars, who were impoverished because there was a tremendous slump in the economy in Britain afterwards. And then they said, oh, we'll give you free land in Africa. And they put them smack on the frontier with the Khoisa, where there was a whole lot of frontier wars, because they thought this would be cheaper than sending a British army there. We have all these demobilized troops that we've got to get rid of, and they give them land in the middle of a war zone, knowing, well, they'll be able to defend themselves. And these poor men were, and probably had to pay taxes too, while providing their own defenses. Just so the 1820 settlers are very sympathetic with the Boers, because they were both in the same situation. They both knew the colonial government was very unfair and unreasonable. But of course the Boers leaving meant that the English 1820 settlers had a harder time. There were less of them to protect the frontier, but there was still sympathy. They stayed because they were British, but a few left. There were a few English people on the Great Trek too.
Is there any truth in the story that the 1820 settlers, when they were taken to the allocated land, were just left there with seeds and
then Yes. I've got very interesting books from Sidney Hudson Reed, who is the Baptist historian of the Baptist Union, who was actually one of my lecturers at college too, and he's written a lot. And he speaks about these poor 1820 settler Baptists who came in. They were basically dumped. You know, if they had seed, they were better off, because some of them were given nothing. They just effectively dumped there, and these poor people had to hack out of the wilderness a livelihood in farms, and many had come with their wives and children, and next thing, and they're put in this very dangerous area where you've got rampaging Khoisa tribes coming in wanting to steal what they've got, and sometimes they've just built their farmhouse and up in flames, church up in flames. So it was a typical government operation. Lie to the people, tax them, and dump them. Yes, so I think that's... And I also saw major work done by Fritz Haus on the German settlers who came into the Eastern Cape, and their experience were also they'd been mercenaries for the British in the Napoleon Wars, and they were also rewarded with this land in Africa, and all thought they were going to be landowners of the, and next thing they actually were basically stuck in the middle of a war zone to lessen the government's need to provide an army to protect the eastern frontier. It's really outrageous. You just think of the kind of people who can make those decisions. There's a certain element or characteristic of politicians that seems to go across the centuries.
But the Romans did that also in Iberia with the they had their legions hired mercenaries from like the eastern bloc, like Romania area, and they just dumped them.
They rewarded them with land.
They couldn't pay them in cash, so they just gave them land in Spain.
Where they would be surrounded by hostiles who'd want to cut their throats, yes. Exactly.
The whole land reclamation thing, which the leftists love, it's interesting travelling overseas and seeing, you know, in Scotland they had the Highland clearances. Where did those people go? They probably came to South Africa. They were dispossessed. In Ireland, the same thing. Potato famine wasn't what chased them away. It was the government using that as to really starve them out.
Mm.
And they were confiscating food, and so there's been this vicious cruelty to from our own people. I mean, where does it always come from?
If you can call them your own people, but the thing that's so touching is to read about the real friendship and bond there was between the 1820 settlers and the Boers, and the English farmers on the ground and the Boer farmers on the ground. They were friends. They were good neighbors. They worked together. The government was the curse. It wasn't the people. And so when you look at this too, you can see when the Boers were attacked at Vianen, the English settlers in Port Natal sent immediately, we use the word commander. I'm sure they wouldn't use the word commander. But they sent everything they could to go and assist them. And there was that real good neighborliness on the ground. So there isn't ground for hostility between English and Boer. It's the governments. That's where you see, and the banksters and those characters, the finances, you know, diamond mine characters. These were a lot of the people working for trouble. But on the ground, the people on the ground are decent people on both sides.
Well, actually, the history in Europe, the English and the Dutch had worked together against the Catholics anyway for quite a long time.
Yes. English were very instrumental in helping the Dutch win their freedom from Spain. Of course, they had a common enemy, but there was... They've got a common faith as being Protestant. So you can imagine there was a general sense of unity. And just take the fact that the Andrew Murray family was Scottish. They come out and they totally assimilate to the Afrikaans people. They learn the language. They fully identify, so that many people today are surprised to hear, what, Andrew Murray came from Scotland? He was born in South Africa, but his father was Scottish. And they just totally assimilated because they had a reformed faith that even though they had different background and languages, but they assimilated. So I think also you can see in Rhodesia, 20% of the white Rhodesians were Afrikaans. 20%. So again, there was many, many Afrikaans people in Rhodesia that you wouldn't have known was not from an English background except from a surname. They were fully next to one another. Now, my generation who served on the border in Southwest Africa, we had no problem. I mean, to me, the Afrikaans people were my best friends. Whereas my father looked at them like the Afrikaans are the enemy. He was that other generation. And he is angry that, the Prime Minister of South Africa didn't support the war, the Second World War, and many of the South African leaders were actually in, locked up in prison camps like Koffiefontein because they refused to support the British war. They weren't willing to be conscripted and things like this. So to my father's generation, the Afrikaans people were treacherous because they wouldn't support the British in their war. And but to my generation, we fought together against a common enemy, the communists, and saw there is no problem with between Afrikaans and English on the ground. It's the problems with our governments. The British government was treacherous. And after all, they betrayed us in Rhodesia. So for me, I never saw the reasoning behind my father's generation's hostility across those lines. So there's some people who, for that matter, I remember having a date with an Afrikaans girl, going back to her family and having her shouted at by her parents, how dare you bring some Bedometer Roynick into our home sort of thing. And I was hearing all this. And, I mean, shame. She was really torn. I knew enough Afrikaans to understand what was going on. And for them, they were reminding, your grandparents lost all their brothers and sisters in a British concentration camp and you bring an Englishman to our home. So there was that generation that had that hatred, but that hatred was government policy. It wasn't the people on the ground. If you think how British people have been betrayed also by their own, just ask the Canadians about Dieppe, for example, or the Aussies and New Zealanders about Gallipoli, you know, used as cannon fodder. So at any rate, I just have always found from a fairly young age an affinity with the Boers, even sitting in Rhodesia going through the history, because I thought, I remember getting into arguments at school with our teachers because I'd take the side of the Boers and they'd say, you know, but you, how can you do that? You know, you're English. And, well, it's obvious our people are only there for the gold and diamonds. This wasn't about any justice. Our people are the aggressors and they were wrong. And so I was sort of scolded for being unpatriotic with that. But my generation, when we served in the same army under the same Aranya Blanya Blow, sang the same distem, fought the same communist enemy on the border, to me, I've got so much in common with my Afrikaans neighbors, and I've got nothing in common with those creeps over there who are putting sanctions on us and betraying Rhodesia. So it's interesting that we can find ourselves often celebrating heroes which might not have been on our side. Yeah. But as Christians, our loyalty transcends our language and culture sometimes, frequently.